Hello everyone and welcome for another episode of Protocol Value. Tonight we have two special guests from Bancor, Nate Hindman and Mark Richardson. Bancor is an on-chain liquidity protocol that enables automated decentralized exchange on Ethereum and across blockchains. Late last year, Bancor released the first ever single-sided liquidity pools protected from impermanent loss. Since then, more than 20,000 users have started providing liquidity to Bancor pools, passively earning liquidity, mining rewards, and on top of that, earning trading fees. Mark, Nate, welcome to Protocol Value. How are you guys?
Thank you so much for having us. We're really excited to be here.
Absolutely. Likewise, thanks, Nikita.
We're actually really excited to have you here. We'll try to have a conversation from an unbiased side, even though we are users of your platform and absolutely love what you guys are doing with DEXs and combining DAOs within that infrastructure. But I guess we can start talking about how many people found about Bancor, including ourselves, is from Nate's blog post on Medium, where Nate, you described as user-owned exchanges. Let's talk about that.
Sure. I think pretty early on, we realized after making AMMs that it allows us to really automate the core functionalities of a DEX, whether that be sort of listing or the matching of buy and sell orders through an AMM. And what this really enables is for a large group of unaffiliated users to be the liquidity providers to a DEX and to therefore really kind of own the DEX and have it instead of like a Binance or a Coinbase where you have sort of a very small amount of liquidity providers. They usually have direct relationships with the actual exchange and are controlled in more of a centralized fashion. Bancor allows for an unlimited amount of unaffiliated users to provide liquidity and to kind of therefore be part owners in the DEX's revenue that are generated by fees from each trade. So it really started to paint this picture for us of a sort of people-owned liquidity infrastructure that sort of serves as a public good that any new project or new idea can access. And instead of having to set up some deal with an exchange in order to list their token and pay super high listing fees, they can just do it permissionlessly on their own by creating a liquidity pool with their token and the exchange's token, in our case, BNT, and that anyone can financially support that project by providing liquidity to the liquidity pool. So this is kind of this vision of a user-owned exchange. And then on the other side of LPs, you have traders, and this is a kind of, if you think of our core sort of user groups, one is the liquidity providers who are generating fees and supporting these projects, and the other are traders who want to buy and sell in and out of different projects. So again, this kind of creates this liquidity infrastructure that is accessible to all people and permissionlessly, and there's no sort of central company controlling this thing. And this is this vision of a sort of DEX as a DAO. And then the DAO really came into reality last year, before there was more of a kind of core community of developers that were really deciding the type of changes that should happen to the protocol. And now all of that sort of decision-making happens on chain. Any user who owns BNT, the protocol token, and provides liquidity generates VBNT, which is the governance token of the protocol, and can then propose changes to the protocol via the DAO and vote with their VBNT. So now in the past, I think about 6 or 7 months, this vision is really coming to reality. And we've seen sort of innovation within Bancor go into sort of light speed, really because anyone can contribute and participate. And if you hold BNT, really guide the direction of where we're headed.
The whole space of decentralized exchanges is very fascinating. And it seems like that space has been rapidly developing since the summer of 2020. And looks like on the Bancor side, once you guys released the DAO part of the DEX, it seems like, according to the data, the liquidity just essentially exploded on the liquidity provider side on your end. And it just gives us a better understanding that there's a lot of individuals or there's a lot of entities that would like to have access to DEXs that have this permissionless access to provide liquidity. Nate, like you mentioned, in this centralized environment where you have as an example of Binance or Coinbase, there's quite a few players on liquidity provider side who can tap into those kind of reserves where market makers take advantage of that and earn them yield on that liquidity. Whereas in this case, decentralized exchanges have this permissionless access, not only that, but in addition to this governance, which is DAO. This is really fascinating on a DAO side because what you guys are doing at Bancor allows users to essentially direct which assets, which pairs to add, which in return drives more liquidity into the protocol. How did DAO picture actually come in during the development? Or is this something that you guys have been planning on doing, or is this just kind of a byproduct of DeFi?
Yeah, I think it was always in the vision of Bancor that the sort of control would be given away to the protocol and to the token holders and BNT holders and the DAO members, of which anyone can become that. And I think this is the blueprint for a lot of DeFi protocols, that there's a sort of core developer that launches this piece of software, and then over time, removes itself from the picture and is still sort of a participant, but similar to any other member in the DAO, you know, has just as much control, and that anyone can sort of access control. Now, I think the key distinction with AMMs versus market making in a centralized exchange is that, you know, it really takes very specialized skills to be a market maker on an order book based exchange, and of which you know most Binance or Coinbase and most of the exchanges that we knew of before AMMs ran on order books. You know, you have to run sort of algorithmic, which I'm sure Nikita, you know of, given your background in traditional finance, you know, it takes a lot of technical skill. There's a high capital barrier. And what we found with AMMs is that, you know, really everyday users who are holders of cryptocurrencies and really believe in projects, especially in their early stages, can now participate as market makers. And you think, well, shouldn't we open up this function of market making to a project's kind of core believers who can then, you know, take their idle assets instead of, you know, having them just sit in their wallet, provide them as market makers to this liquidity pool, and without having to constantly sort of update their buy and sell orders and having to utilize sort of specialized skills that are, you know, typically mostly reserved for, you know, professional market makers that do this for a living and are active and constantly watching it and have a team of, you know, MIT algorithmic PhDs. You know, you can just in a couple clicks with as little money as you want, be a part of the project as a market maker. And that's especially useful, like I said, in the early stages of a token when they don't necessarily have the funds or the resources to hire, you know, an active trading firm to do their market making and set up these deals with exchanges. So it was really this, you know, they call it democratization of market making that I think has sort of created this idea of liquidity from the crowd that really started to make a lot of sense with our DAO as well. Once that emerged, what's sort of interesting about our DAO is that in order to be a participant, you also have to be a liquidity provider. The process is, you know, we have BNT that sits as the protocol, as the asset in each token pair on the exchange. And so you can take your BNT, once you stake it in a pool, you're essentially making up the BNT side of each pool. There's the risk asset, and then there's BNT within each pool. And then as a BNT liquidity provider, you then generate VBNT, and VBNT is the sort of governance token of Bancor and allows you to propose and vote on different proposals. So there's, you know, a direct overlap between the governance token holders and the sort of key participant in this ecosystem, which is liquidity providers. And, you know, we thought that was sort of particularly important that the people that were, you know, guiding the future also have sort of skin in the game and were the people that were, you know, putting their assets on the line. And so today, I think there's about 70% or actually close to now 80% of total BNT locked up in the protocol in existence, which I think is a testament to how active some of these LPs have been. Yeah, so that's generally how now you asked a question of the sort of role in the DAO, and I think that's something we can dig into a little more, but effectively one of the key services that Bancor offers is these two core features in V2.1 that have sort of led to its recent popularity, and that is one, single-sided liquidity and impermanent loss protection. Now, in traditional AMMs, as I said, Bancor is really the first and existed in sort of its first generation form for about, 2.5 years. You saw a lot of competitors kind of clone mm-hmm. Bancor and adopt this model. And in this sort of traditional model that most AMMs are, with the exception of Bancor today, a user has to provide two tokens into the pool. So let's say they are a link holder and want to provide link liquidity, they'll have to provide it in both link and ETH, if it's sort of a link ETH pool, and also be exposed to a risk called impermanent loss, which when there is lots of divergence between the two tokens or really any divergence whatsoever, you're effectively sort of selling off one of the assets and acquiring the other. And this can lead to a phenomenon in which when you pull out your assets, they're worth less than if you had just held them on their own inside your wallet. So these were kind of really two core issues that we wanted to tackle in our latest version, and allow users to provide and maintain exposure to just a single asset. So in the case of Link, providing just Link, and I'm exposed to the same Link price movements as if I held Link in my wallet, and also impermanent loss protection. So if you hold your tokens in the pool for a given amount of time today, that's, if you hold the tokens in for at least 30 days, there's something called impermanent loss protection, which is sort of effectively like insurance. And that starts at 30 days in the pool and then increases by 1% each day until 100 days when you are fully protected against any impermanent loss that occurred in that first 100 days or any time thereafter. And then when the LP withdraws or you withdraw, you're effectively compensated by the protocol for any impermanent loss that you've taken on. So this ability for the DAO to effectively offer this insurance is really what kind of gives it its sort of power. Now, you know, the Bancor DAO can currently offer these services, but only to a subset of the tokens on Bancor and that are those that are whitelisted. So there's this process of whitelisting whereby the DAO sort of determines whether the token is suitable for whitelisting and determines actually how much it wants to invest BNT into that pool in order to enable single-sided liquidity and impermanent loss protection. Currently, I think there's about probably 80 tokens whitelisted on the protocol. Mm-hmm. And that number is growing each day, but it's really how DAO participants can sort of actively and signal their intent and which tokens they want to support and want to offer these services to. And it's really given the DAO sort of this this powerful tool in the crypto community that is attracting a lot of projects and a lot of collaborations, and so that's how the model really evolved.
It seems like the majority of the first-handed liquidity actually came from the Link BNT pair. Seems like Link Marines, the known force within the crypto community, just essentially saw an opportunity for an increased yield, and especially a community-like exchange, and dove right into it. And it seems like throughout the last 4 months, just the share of Link BNT or Link, even seems like Ethereum on any swap in terms of the market value and liquidity has been growing on Bancor side and acquiring a lot more market share out of other competitors, which is essentially exciting to see, because it seems like Link Marines is the community that follows a lot of innovating technology, but also rewarding for a community level governance, which is really exciting. Something that you mentioned regarding the impermanent loss, I would like to touch upon that, because I don't think a lot of people realize what impermanent loss is. And to simplify what it is, it's essentially a deviation of the market value or the prices, depending on the quantity, with a 50-50% split between two tokens. Let's say, for example, if you have two stable coins, the price deviation not necessarily will occur, and therefore there's not going to be any impermanent loss. But whenever you change one side of the equation, when you have one side of the stablecoin and another side, let's say Ethereum tends to appreciate throughout time, whereas the stablecoin tends to stay pegged to $1. That deviation in the price essentially creates risk for liquidity provider. And that risk is usually offset to liquidity provider and a lot of other DEXs. So what Bancor is essentially doing, it compensates throughout an existence of your liquidity position for that deviation in price using BNT as a native utility token, which has a very elastic release schedule. And that's something interesting that I would like to also explore, guys, on your end, if you can simplify how BNT elastic release is essentially affecting BNT net-net in terms of the actual circulation supply or just the actual market share.
Sure. Mark, do you want to take this one?
Yeah, certainly. So I want to make sure that I understood the question correctly. You're asking how the elastic supply affects properties such as the circulating supply and the market share.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah, the Bancor protocol is able to create BNT when it needs it and destroy it when it doesn't need it anymore. And so this is sort of an interesting development, I think, for a lot of our token holders, because it means that things like circulating supply become a slightly more complicated topic. So when Bancor version 2.1 launched in October of 2020, it started with, I think, an initial supply of about 69 million tokens. And those 69 million tokens had been, you know, more or less constant. And this is the kind of fixed, you know, fixed supply that a lot of people are used to dealing with. However, in order to power the impermanent loss protection mechanism and also the single-sided liquidity provision, it's actually necessary that the protocol can create tokens in order to support that liquidity when it's provided. And also it may need to mint BNT in order to pay for insurance. So these are, you know, essentially inescapable properties that we need to have built into the protocol. And in order to automate them, right, in order to not have some gatekeeper that controls, for example, a vault of value that decides when and where these funds should be spent and to whom, it's so much easier just to have an elastic supply that means that it's completely immutable, and there is you know, no one at the core of it deciding where those funds are spent, which is good. So what this means is when the DAO decides that they want to whitelist a new token, so whitelist just means it's a token that has met the basic security standards and is from a project that the DAO is convinced is legitimate. And, you know, is serious, that the DAO's convinced that they're going to be around for a long time and they've got a healthy community and we trust the team. When a token reaches that level of trust, we can grant it insurance. And that means that anyone that holds that particular token is then able to contribute single-sided liquidity free from impermanent loss. But every time a token holder supplies the token that they are providing liquidity with, it's really important that at that exact instant that the token enters the pool, that there is already a BNT token there essentially waiting for it. And so this is what the Bancor protocol, this is the moment in which the Bancor protocol creates new BNTs. So let's say that, Nikita, let's say you're trying to provide liquidity with a new favorite token. Do you have any, by the way? Is there something in the Ethereum space that you're super interested in that's kind of new and upcoming?
Well, there's BNT, and there's and there are a couple other tokens. I would say Aave is very fascinating protocol. Link is definitely sure. Decentralized oracles.
That's fine. Let's go with Aave. I mean, this is one that's already whitelisted on our mm-hmm. system. So basically, you might have heard via our Twitter channels or via Telegram or however you get your news that Bancor has just whitelisted the Aave token. So this means that you can now approach the pool and you see that it's there waiting for you on the app. And you would click a little button with a cross in it that says, you know, provide liquidity. When you click that button, it will tell you how much liquidity is actually available for provision. So there's a hard cap that's effectively an insurance limit or a risk limit that the DAO is willing to tolerate for that token. And so for Aave, you know, it might say that there's room for, you know, 1 or 2 million Aave or something like that. And so you then provide those tokens, but as you're providing them, in order to participate in the 50-50 liquidity pool, there literally needs to be the exact amount of value on the other side of the pool in BNT to pair with your Aave tokens as they're being deposited. And so as you provide, let's say, you know, $2,000 worth in Aave liquidity, the protocol will mint from nothingness $2,000 worth of BNT to supply the other side. And when it does that, that means the supply of BNT is actually going up. A lot of people see this event and see what's happened to the BNT supply since the launch of V2.1, and they misconstrue the growth or the expansion of the BNT supply with inflation. And there's an important distinction here, I think, between inflation in the sense that, you know, people should be worried about it, and benign inflation, which doesn't actually have any price impact at all. Mm-hmm. So it's important to realize here that when the protocol is minting BNT to support these single-sided liquidity providers, that BNT is by no means, on the open market or in circulation. It's kind of bound up in the pool. And as opposed to the regular kind of inflation, like mining rewards, which is something that Bancor certainly has as well, which is a different kettle of fish. But, you know, even just things like the Bitcoin inflation that happened during, you know, its first launch, mm-hmm. where its supply went from zero to, you know, like 80% of the available Bitcoin relatively quickly. And this causes, you know, massive selling pressure because those tokens kind of don't have anywhere else to be. And, anyone who's holding them, you're kind of always hedging the fact that they could sell them at any time. Whereas on Bancor, the BNT that's provided by the protocol never has any ambition to sell it, right? It's the world's largest BNT whale, and it essentially never sells its BNT, which is kind of a nice thing to have. If you have a look at where inflation or, you know, token concentration in very few hands has ended up a problem. Things like Doge, I think, come to mind, where something like 99% of the supply is held by like 15% of wallets. You need a lot of trust, I think, in the whales of Doge in order to want to hold that coin. Because if they ever turned around and got bored with the project, their ability to dramatically reduce the price of Doge by selling it is catastrophic. Whereas for BNT, the protocol is always going to be the largest holder, and it doesn't even have the option to sell. However, that doesn't mean that there isn't a slight effect on the price because of the nature of the liquidity pools. Whenever the BNT price is rising on external markets, so for example, Binance, Coinbase, wherever, there will be an arbitrage opportunity created between those order books and the automatic markets on Bancor. So a well-informed arbitrageur will be incentivized to essentially purchase BNT from the liquidity pools at a lower price and then sell them on Binance or Coinbase at a higher price. But in doing so, as they're extracting BNT from the pool, which you could argue is kind of the instant in which the inflationary BNT associated with, you know, liquidity provision becomes a part of the circulating supply, and I think that that is a good argument. It's worth pointing out that as it became a part of the circulating supply, it actually pushed the price up. And so this is kind of the counterintuitive part of BNT inflation, is that it's inflating when the price is going up, and it is deflating when the price is going down. And so in a sense, the Bancor protocol isn't just the world's biggest BNT whale, it's also the world's biggest BNT swing trader. It is basically buying every dip and selling, you know, taking profits on the way up. So, you know, there's no free lunch. The price stability that we see in the price floor for BNT due to the protocol's ability to absorb selling pressure is very nice. But it also means that we require a little bit more momentum on the upside as well. But, you know, having a look at the volumes that we see on centralized exchanges during bull markets, there's really nothing to be concerned about. I'd say that the best testament to this is the fact that after the V2.1 launch and, you know, during a lot of this minting into liquidity pools and expanding the protocol, the price has still managed to do essentially a 20x run. And it's still, you know, it's come down a little bit since its peak, but it's still mostly sort of crabbing sideways. So it's not like the proof is in the pudding, is what I'm trying to say.
Really interesting that you mentioned the inflation, which is currently what we are seeing with the excessive supply of the US dollar. And something important to mention to all the listeners is that inflation is essentially a combination of the actual circulating amount of a certain currency or token versus the actual swap or the exchange for the supply of the good. And if there is an imbalance on one side of the equation, that's where the inflation essentially is derived from, which essentially what Mark, you mentioned, is the circulating supply. It's really fascinating how you guys were able to find a way to develop this ecosystem around your own native token and actually drive utility from it, whereas the majority of other exchanges, decentralized exchanges on Ethereum, use either wrapped Ethereum or just Ethereum as a core swapping mechanism. But also something very interesting in your case, which I haven't seen on any other DEX, is the issuance of VBNT. Nate, like you mentioned, VBNT serves as a core driving mechanism for voting within Bancor DAO, for issuing certain pairs and whitelisting them. But also, it can be used as a leverage, which is probably, again, I haven't found anything like this in any other DEXs. So let's talk about VB&T. How is leverage determined? Is there a dynamic form? Is that based on BNT? What are the benefits and what you can do with it?
Yeah, so VB&T is essentially a BNT derivative. So when a user contributes BNT to a liquidity pool and to a whitelisted liquidity pool, they receive VB&T at a rate of 1-to-1 with the BNT that they provided. So if you've provided 100 BNT to a liquidity pool, the protocol will issue 100 VBNT, but it's not a wrapper, right? It's not a pool token. It doesn't appreciate in value the same way. It's more like a key to the safe that holds your BNT that's accruing in value. So as swap revenue accumulates on your stake, the amount of BNT that you are entitled to withdraw can go up. So let's say it's a good year and you get 100% APY or something, then your 100 BNT might be worth 200 BNT at the end of 12 months. But it still only requires 100 BNT, the initial BNT that was issued to you, to unlock it. And so the theory behind this is that if you are a BNT liquidity provider, then you should have a voting right in government. And so VBNT is issued to you to fulfill that purpose. However, when you are leaving the Bancorp protocol, when you are withdrawing your BNT, then it stands to reason that you should be relinquishing those voting rights as you leave. And so this is the process where VBNT is issued as you're participating. And then when you choose to not participate anymore, that is when the VBNT disappears and you can no longer affect the results of government. And so that was really the main purpose of the VBNT for a long time. But then on a call with E.L. Herzog, who is one of the original founders of Bancor, he mentioned this, you know, idea that he had for a sort of a credit system surrounding VBNT. Because one of the things that we know about it is that it is required to unlock all of the user BNT on the Bancor protocol. And so that kind of has a value associated with it, not necessarily as a pure form of collateral, but maybe as a type of speculative debt. So what we were interested in developing was an interest-free and liquidation-free loan system where Bancor liquidity providers would be able to access some of the value associated with their stake and therefore have the kind of flexibility to participate in other market activities should they choose. But that doesn't require them to actually unstake any of their BNT. And this is important because stake BNT is such an important health metric for us. Stake BNT is one of the things that opens up, you know, the room on the single-sided liquidity for the TKN side of the pool. It also means that that's BNT that's essentially, you know, out of people's wallets and out of their hands where they might be tempted to sell it on Binance or something. And so, you know, it's a bullish metric to have a lot of people's BNT stake, and being able to give people the sort of flexibility that they want by not necessarily committing capital that just lies in wait of them, you know, withdrawing from the protocol one day is something that we wanted to support. So, we're armed with the idea that VBNT is required by everyone who's owned it to unlock their BNT on the protocol at some point in the future. What can we do? If you set up a liquidity pool between BNT and VBNT, you have a sort of an interesting situation because anyone that sells their VBNT on that pool can extract BNT from it. But that means that all of the VBNT that they've sold will need to be purchased back at some point, mm-hmm. because they won't be able to unlock their BNT stakes without it. This also means that as they start selling VBNT on that pool, due to the nature of bonding curves, it's necessarily going to force the price down. And so as the protocol as a whole, or I should say as users as a whole, enter into these leveraged states as they start taking loans, it will start pushing the price of VBNT down far enough that the risk to taking any more loans, right, in order to the risk to leveraging your position further becomes very strongly disincentivized. So if you think about that process, if you're selling BB&T to buy it back later, that sounds a lot like a short sell. And from the perspective of the liquidity provider, that's essentially what it is. If you're selling your BB&T in order to access value, but you need to reverse that that process later, what you're hoping is that you can rebuy the BB&T at the same price or a lower price at some point in the future. What's interesting about that is that it kind of replaces, or you know, that risk, that speculation about the future price of BB&T. It essentially replaces interest rates or liquidation as a form of debt management. So usually when, you know, the interest rate is going up, like the, you know, the Federal Reserve or the Federal Bank or the World Bank or whatever is going to have a discussion about interest rates, it's usually, you know, with a view to managing how rapidly people are taking on new debt and also to manage or incentivize people to repay existing debt. On Bancor, we don't really have to worry about that. Because the incentive to take loans is kind of managed by the amount of debt itself. As you keep selling BB&T into the curve, it keeps pushing the price down, which means that the amount of value that you can extract for that sale is also going down, which pushes your risk up. So we've basically managed to completely supplant interest rate and liquidation systems with a speculative future debt price for the system. And so this has attracted, you know, people that want to speculate on the price of BB&T, who are essentially participating, whether they know it or not, in a debt market, right? It's kind of like buying and selling mortgage obligations or something like that. Mm-hmm. But it's, you know, it's highly tokenized and you can do it at any scale. And so this has proven to be an extremely popular thing, by the way. I was instrumental, by the way, in designing the system and sort of stress testing it and, you know, trying to break it. We also set up an economic bug bounty, which I think is one of the first in cryptocurrency. So not necessarily looking for bugs in the smart contract, but looking for bugs in the economic principles behind the idea. And I think that was worth $50,000 and was available for several weeks before we started coding it. And obviously it was never claimed, although a few people tried. At that design stage, it really wasn't clear how people were going to react. When I was thinking about different levels or, you know, restrictions that we should put on it, I was really worried actually that people would think, you know, this is too risky for me. I don't really want to do it. Why would I risk losing my BNT or something like that? And especially with providing liquidity as well, it wasn't clear to me whether or not people would see the advantage of providing liquidity with BB&T in order to support this kind of debt mechanism. But actually it very quickly became one of the most important features of the protocol, and users are really enjoying it. And you know, that's reflected in the low price of BB&T today. Which means that actually there's a lot of liquidity providers who are in leveraged positions, which is, you know, in a way, it's kind of a sign of capital efficiency.
It's very interesting the way that you guys designed it, that when you're issued BB&T and you either lose BB&T or depreciates versus the, when you swap it to a different asset, for example, BNT or something else, and that asset actually underperforms BB&T, you're essentially left with less BB&T, and therefore you're not able to withdraw your initial liquidity that you supply with Bancor, which essentially locks in your liquidity within the protocol, rewarding the protocol with liquidity, which essentially in turn reduces the slippage for the traders, and punishes you for taking more either uncontrolled risk or a different risk methodology that did not work out in your specific favor.
It's important to point out here, though, that even if the risk kind of gets away from you, like let's say you make a really bad decision, mm-hmm. and you sold all your BB&T at a low price, and now the BB&T price is slightly higher. Unlike a liquidation where those funds are kind of taken from you and there's not much you can do about it, in this case, if you're patient enough, right, it could be that the price of BB&T comes back again and you may still have a future opportunity to reclaim that position. And that's never going to go away. That's indefinite. Mm-hmm. So, you know, even though the risk profile can seem extreme at times, and it certainly is, it's something that I have to caution users about using all the time. But it's even in the face of that extreme volatility, it's because of the permanence of it, right? Because it's a perpetual option that you essentially have on repaying that debt mm-hmm. that never accrues interest and is never liquidated. The profile is actually extremely gentle. And yeah, I think that's one of the reasons why we've found it to be to garner so much traction so quickly.
And it seems like over the long term, if you smooth out the volatility net-net, given the previous historical data that we have for VBNT, the VBNT rate is essentially going to be lower in the long term, unless there's going to be some volatility spikes where there's going to be liquidity events where, let's say, for example, there is a meteor striking Earth and everybody's running for their cash. And a lot of LPs, for example, this is obviously an extreme example, but an example nonetheless of a liquidity event where certain persons or entities need to withdraw some portion of the liquidity in order to satisfy some different obligations, whether in their personal life or other obligations when they're taking other risks in different areas of their life. This is the only event in this case that I can come up with where the VBNT price will essentially go up disproportionately.
Yeah.
Because like you said,
tax season, for example, might also be another instigator. Mm-hmm. Where, you know, people realize that for some of the gains that they've made in cryptocurrency, that they are, you know, now responsible to provide some of that back to their government. This could be another sort of seasonal part of the cycle that I think we will start to see playing out on longer timeframes for VBNT.
Seems like that's actually what we're seeing right now in crypto markets. Over the last week, where we were seeing a lot of downside volatility. Filing tax rate in the US was actually pushed out to May 17th, which is essentially today, coincidentally.
Right.
and we've seen a lot of downside volatility where there's a lot of liquidity leaving the crypto assets to satisfy their tax obligations.
I was going to say that there's, you know, we shouldn't rule out the possibility of a short squeeze either.
Mm-hmm.
If the VBNT price does go very low, similar to what we saw with GME, very clever users with sufficient organization skills may be able to rally support to, you know, to buy a lot of it. And as the price comes up, this could actually incentivize people that have already sold into it to try and recover some of that VBNT before the price continues up. Mm-hmm. And the act of them exiting from leverage will only cause the VBNT price to rise even further and even faster. So I actually am expecting, because the price of VBNT has gone quite low, that mm-hmm. something like a short squeeze event is probably on the cards for Bancor's future for VBNT. However, similar to the fact that they're, you know, or the gentleness, the relative lack of risk compared to, you know, traditional debt markets, I expect it to be a lot slower, right? So it's not going to be this catastrophic, you know, liquidation cascade that pushes the price, you know, 10x in a few minutes or something like we see on FTX and, you know, on Bybit and things like that. But it could play out, you know, in more or less the same way, just on a longer time frame. But, you know, time will tell. It's not clear how that market is going to work. But this is cryptocurrency, right? Anything can happen.
At the relatively low price of VBNT relative to the BNT price really has indicated to us that there is very high demand for users who want to borrow against their staked capital. You know, as Mark described, as people are selling their VBNT in order to take leverage and do some sort of financial activity while their BNT is staked in Bancor, you know, as this VBNT is being sold, the price is going down relative to BNT. As it's bought back for people to unlock their BNT, the price of VBNT will go up. So it shows that, you know, and our stats on, you know, how many people have swapped their VBNT really backs this up, that there is a lot of demand for people that want to borrow against their staked liquidity. And so we really feel that we've just scratched the surface of what's possible in sort of blending the usage of an AMM for both market making, but also for borrowing and lending. And we've really just scratched the surface in that domain. And I think VBNT has sort of served as a huge validation of this type of activity that LPs want to do. You know, if your BNT is staked in the protocol, and you see some very interesting, you know, yield farming opportunity in another protocol, you know, up until now, LPs have had to unlock their BNT in order to participate. And now they can do so without having to unlock their BNT. And it sort of allows this kind of fluidity in and out of different DeFi ecosystems, and where the sort of base asset is this tokenized liquidity that can sort of move and be used in other ways. So it's definitely been encouraging and sort of counterintuitive. People have asked us, well, you know, why is the VBNT price so low? Is this something you're concerned about? And if anything, it's quite bullish for us that there is such high demand and so many users are taking this leverage and utilizing it. So it's really, I think, encouraged us to keep building in this sort of design space of let's call it leveraged liquidity provision, or, you know, borrowing against staked liquidity.
Very interesting kind of dynamics at play that you have to wrap your head around. That's when something goes down in price, it's actually bullish overall for the protocol, and serves essentially as a design feature where a lot of people are usually interpreting something that appreciates throughout time as a value-driven addition to the protocol. But also something interesting, we've covered a lot of topics on the LP side, which is detrimental to banker success. Something also from the user perspective who are just getting into DeFi, and what we're envisioning here at Protocol Value, there's going to be a quite substantial DeFi boom this summer, given a lot of L2 migrations and Arbitrum potentially lowering fees and entries for new users. You guys essentially took that idea and said, okay, we're not going to wait for the Arbitrum. We're not going to wait for L2 migration to lower the fees. We're going to introduce limit orders where users can now perform gas-free limit orders. And depending on the limit that you choose within the execution range, your order will be executed and the gas is going to be paid by the delivering side. How did this come about? This is something, again, I've never seen on any other decks, but very, very useful feature and something that a lot of traders that's in a centralized finance on equities and derivatives use quite a lot.
Yeah, so obviously in this climate, especially in the past few weeks when we've seen such a spike in gas costs, this has become particularly useful for traders. And in general, it's sort of, as you mentioned, we have focused a lot of time on building a superior product for LPs. And the way these sort of AMM markets work is you really have to serve the traders too. So we're spending a lot of time now, you know, shifting some focus to designing new products for traders and redesigning the Bancor front end too, to allow for, you know, a better trader experience. At the end of the day, you know, you need trade volume from aggregators who are sort of, you know, third parties that are routing traffic into Bancor, but also we've seen the value of direct traffic users that are traders and want to swap in and out of new tokens, old tokens, change their positions, and use sort of Bancor.network as this one-stop DeFi shop where they can not only trade, but once they have the assets in their wallet, can get the best yield in DeFi by staking those assets inside the pool. And then also we've discussed sort of the kind of lending and borrowing capabilities. Now, limit orders was really a push to provide this sort of, you know, full stack trader experience, and was really one of our first efforts into building a more, you know, sophisticated platform for traders. It utilizes some DeFi Legos, in particular, KeeperDAO is a sort of key core functionality that is allowing us to fulfill these limit orders. And also the 0x protocol is being used in this integration. But just like other limit orders, it effectively allows users to, you know, set prices at which they want to buy or sell assets. And like you said, there's no gas paid by the trader. It's paid by the taker. So the person who ends up taking the trade or the party that ends up taking the trade when it's eventually executed. And so we've seen way more usage of this product. I think it just launched probably about 3 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. And in the past 2 weeks or week when gas prices have really spiked, we've seen a lot more usage of it. And it's really helping a lot of traders discover Bancor.network not only as a place to get yield on their assets, but also as a place to do their trading. I think as we lower the barrier also to whitelisting on Bancor, and we see more and more tokens that really use Bancor as their liquidity of first resort, that, you know, traders will more and more come to us when, you know, they realize that this is all the sort of hottest DeFi tokens. If you want to purchase them and swap them between them, you know, in their earliest days, and Bancor is this sort of key place where they list because all these benefits to the project and the LPs. I think that will be a very big moment too for traders showing up at Bancor.network instead of some of the other trading interfaces they've used up until now. But limit orders was definitely our first kind of foray into building Bancor.network into a way more robust destination for traders.
It's kind of reminds me of the early days of Amazon. And what specifically I'm referring to is the Amazon flywheel effect. Whereas in this case, for the decentralized exchange environment, you have a lot of LPs coming to the space providing liquidity, which in return reduces slippage for traders. When you have a low slippage environment, you attract a lot more traders for the execution side, which essentially drives the volume of trades and therefore increases the fees and potentially rewards depending on certain whitelisting effects that the DAO takes, which in return attracts more liquidity providers. And in my view, you can just spin this flywheel to infinity and you have a growing, healthy community, which essentially just feeds off of itself. This is, again, something that I haven't seen any other DEX to successfully employ. And Bancor seems to be a leading pioneer in that technology. What do you guys...
I guess to just add to that is, I think Amazon was successful not only because in its early days, the sort of books it offered, you know, potentially you could get them at a lower or equal price as you could in your local bookstore, but also because it opened the door for anyone to sell anything and to sell any book. Let's stick with books, for instance. So it was the supply of Amazon. The fact that, you know, I could go down to my local bookstore and there would sort of be a limited supply of books that I can get. Whereas if I were to go on to Amazon, this just massive global supply of anyone who's wants to sell a book could do so. And I guess that's the sort of parallel that we really think that the power of AMMs and Bancor in particular offers, which is the supply of assets that anyone can list an asset on Bancor. Anyone can just go to Bancor.network and create a pool with BNT. And so it just creates this sort of long tail of assets, and the new assets that everyone loves with the low market cap. If you think it's promising technology, you can see the asset go, you know, crazy, like 100x. And so it's really this kind of supply that traders can tap into that I think is so exciting for, you know, for the community. And a unique part of Bancor is also that BNT is in every pair. And you refer to this sort of flywheel effect that as each pool gets deeper, the rates get cheaper for swapping. It attracts more volume, which in turn delivers more fees to liquidity providers and increases the incentive. And the fees actually get recompounded, you know, into the pools. When there's a fee of each trade, it gets redeposited into the pool, which then increases the depth. And you have this flywheel effect. But what's so cool about having a common reserve asset inside each pool is that as the BNT price rises, let's say there's more demand for providing liquidity in BNT. So people want to purchase BNT in order to stake it and get these really juicy yields. As the BNT price rises, that naturally increases the depth of each pool. And it sort of, you know, really accelerates this sort of flywheel effect. Now, you'll get a similar effect on if you were to use ETH, for instance. Like some of our competitors use ETH as the common reserve asset, and they see a similar effect if ETH goes up in price. We just think there's something particularly powerful about tying protocol usage to protocol capacity. And directly tying those, lots of different things affect the price of ETH, but you know, the core determining factor of BNT is the sort of usage of the protocol. And as that usage increases, there's a natural increase in the capacity, you know, in the form of deepened liquidity in each of the pools.
That's, again, just reinforces the macro understanding that there's so much upside for this protocol. And just onboarding of the users and just the whole flywheel effect just can be spun into infinity. Like you said, something that I didn't know, which are the fees are actually being redeposited into the pools in order to drive more liquidity, which is really fascinating. But in order for, it seems like the whole industry to go, there is a huge incentive for the gas fees on Ethereum because majority of the dApps, DeFi, is created on Ethereum blockchain. There's a lot of scaling and a lot of reduction of fees that needs to happen in order to drive this user base. So what are you guys' plans for L2 migration, Arbitrum? Is there anything you guys are able to share with us?
So one of the things that you know, that I will say is that absolutely layer two is a huge priority for us. You know, we've watched on with amazement as Polygon has become sort of this giant among the L2s. It's amazing to think that, you know, just 6 months ago, I don't think that the Polygon had even entered the common vernacular. I think at that stage, everyone was still referring to it as Matic. I'm not even sure if they'd rebranded yet. But very much the L2 race was still sort of seen as being fought between Optimism and Arbitrum speculatively. And then out of the woodwork, right, the Polygon goes from being this kind of B-lister to a premium layer to scaling solution in very short length of time. And I think that this kind of, you know, this anecdote serves to sort of strengthen Bancor's, I don't want to say skepticism, but let's say caution about how it approaches the layer two game. So, you know, I think a lot of users have got the wrong idea when they heard that Bancor has a deployment of the contracts on the Arbitrum testnet. We certainly do have that, but it doesn't mean that we're married to Arbitrum. We're not married to it, right? We can go to Arbitrum if we want to, and we're really interested to see how that chain performs after its release. But we really reserve the right to remain, you know, to remain cautious until these layer two solutions prove themselves. I think that after watching Polygon perform and seeing the user traction that it's managed to generate, we are absolutely convinced that Polygon is going to continue to be a success. And I don't think that people should be surprised to see Bancor launch there at some point in the future. That doesn't necessarily mean, though, that that if we did launch on Polygon, that it would be the only layer two deployment that we have. I don't necessarily see any of the layer two solutions as being a sort of an exclusive game. It's more like the Ethereum ecosystem has just kind of grown in complexity. Mm-hmm. And so it might make sense to have a layer two deployment on all of the layer two scaling solutions. For example, there may be some applications that run better on Optimism over Arbitrum and the other way around. I think that Arbitrum is likely to have a slightly better finality on layer one than Optimism will. So I think at this stage, we're still estimating about a 7-day delay to transfer assets from layer one up to Optimism. Whereas I think Arbitrum is significantly lower than that. So you could imagine with time-sensitive applications, there may be dApps on Arbitrum that are better suited to that level of finality, whereas things like, you know, maybe borrowing and lending, not necessarily as time-sensitive, mm-hmm. may be able to operate on things like Optimism and Polygon without too much friction. So what I'm trying to draw attention to is the fact that it's a horses for courses sort of situation. There are going to be projects that prefer Arbitrum or prefer Optimism and prefer Polygon, and they will all have their own reasons for that. But I suspect that if they are still driving, you know, their own token economies, that they will still need a DEX to support them there. And so it could be the case that, you know, the Bancor deployment on Polygon looks very different to the Bancor deployment on Arbitrum or Optimism. Because, you know, we are going to want to deploy pools on those specific deployments that that service the communities that live on that particular layer two scaling solution. And I think that this kind of, you know, this speaks to our strategy for a multi-blockchain universe as a whole. You know, it's not the case that Bancor is an Ethereum-specific dApp. We've already had cross-chain implementations on EOS. And so we understand, you know, cross-chain performance quite well. It's not even, you know, it's not just the layer twos on Ethereum that we're looking at. It should come as no surprise that we're also looking at super blockchains that have garnered a huge amount of user traction, such as Binance Smart Chain. Solana is another one that's really interesting. XDAI, you know, there are all of these different ecosystems. They're going to have their own specific tokens that require liquidity. And, you know, Bancor will be looking to service that entire clientele, regardless of which blockchain or sidechain it's on. So I think that's kind of our layer two strategy. We still feel that it's too early. You know, Polygon is certainly working out really well, but it's unclear to us which, you know, how to fragment the liquidity that we have and which pools need support on Polygon specifically. Because if Optimism or Arbitrum launches and we see, you know, projects start to move over there, then, you know, that's going to mean that there's a lot of wasted energy essentially preparing for something that didn't quite come to fruition or didn't turn out the way that we wanted. So we're still taking it slow. You know, we've done cross-chain stuff before. We think a lot of these newer projects feel like, you know, this is the first time there's been something that is threatened to compete with Ethereum or steal projects from Ethereum. Mm-hmm. It's not, right? We've already been there, and we know, I guess, better, or at least we have a war-hardened caution that comes with, you know, anything that claims to be an improvement on Ethereum. But, you know, we're open-minded and we will do whatever makes sense as soon as it makes sense, but not a moment before.
It seems like you guys have a lot of essentially projects that you are contemplating and what are deploying, and essentially L2 migration and different solutions is a big part of that. Right. Seems specifically there's so many choices now, whereas about a year ago there was only two, which is Optimism and Arbitrum. Now we have so many others, like we have Polygon, we have different other chains that a lot of DApps potentially maybe deploying, like you mentioned XDAI, with their transaction fees considerably lower than Ethereum. But again, like you mentioned, the industry has been through that, and it's not deviating its way from the Ethereum ecosystem. So I want to hear what you guys have in store for us. What are you guys working on that should excite either BNT holder liquidity provider or a trader from a user perspective. Is there anything you would like to share with us?
Yeah, there's a lot that I wish I could share with you, but due to competitive risk, we still like to play our cards pretty close to our chest. There is something that I'm pretty happy to talk about, and that's that we've recently started collaborating with the UMA project, and also with another options-based protocol called Siren. And so we're still in the very early phases of discussions there. But basically, we approached them with this idea that we would like to create a system on their platform where VBNT holders can create call options. And the reason for this, I think, should be pretty clear. Mm-hmm. We spoke about the lending system before and the fact that, it's effectively a speculative risk that you're taking. That you're going to be able to rebuy your BB&T at the same price or a lower price that you sold it for. But certainly there's not a huge amount of confidence that you would have if you're selling BB&T at a low price like it is now. And so that might discourage people from participating simply because, they have to sleep eventually, or they've got a full-time job and they can't be at their computer, 24 hours a day to respond to sudden market changes. And that's understandable. However, can you imagine how useful it would be that if you sold your BBNT at, say, 0.1 and then immediately bought a call option for BBNT at the same price? This means that you would now have this, this window up into the expiry of that option within which you can kind of do whatever you want. If the market continues down, if the VBNT price continues down, you already know that you're safe. But if it suddenly spikes back up, that your option is now going to be in the money. And so I think that this is going to be a really interesting way to promote even further utilization of the VBNT loan structure, while also giving VBNT holders that aren't leveraging their position a way to earn passive yields by creating those call options. I think that there could also be new market participants for which there is no common vernacular to describe them. But basically people that are interested in speculating on VBNT, who see opportunities to buy it at a low price and then immediately go and create call options with it at a higher strike price. And so, I think that this is going to be a really exciting way to sort of grow out the system and make it a little bit more robust in the long term.
This is actually something very exciting, again, that you guys are thinking of this three-dimensional leverage of not only providing BB&T, but also allowing derivatives on top of that to hedge your risks if you're taking some. And if you're not, you can essentially sell those options or provide the opposite side where you can earn some protective yield on that. By providing some liquidity into that option market for somebody to essentially hedge against their own risks. Very, very
exciting.
Yeah,
it's cool. It's cool, right? Like, I think that this is actually like a, we're slowly sort of, it's slowly coming into focus. The fact that we've created something that I think has actual sort of economic novelty and, and utility to it. I can see this as being sort of a general product. I would be surprised if we don't see more things like it, or things modeled after it in the future, just because it's working so well.
Something that really interesting that just came up into my imagination, that you guys can down the road create these derivative contracts in style of options onto multitude of different effects using different data. So for example, you have VBNT, right, or BNT elastic supply, and you can hedge against the potential inflation to the upside or the downside. There's so many ways that, given the current infrastructure of the protocol, you can innovate on top and create brand new derivative products that the world has never seen before.
Yeah, there's a lot of room to move, honestly. And you're right. That's something I've actually been thinking about just last week. So it's interesting you brought that up, this kind of idea of being able to hedge against inflation or, you know, or even hedge against deflation in some cases is something mm-hmm. that, you know, you would certainly, I think there would be a lot of interest in these kinds of products. I really need to spend a lot of time. Maybe, you know, I should sit down and pick your brain once. You know, it's so rare that I get to get on the phone with a derivatives expert, but yeah, you know, I'm so glad that you brought that up because it makes me feel sort of validated in my thinking.
And I guess zooming out, you know, people talk a lot about like what are the moats in DeFi protocol? How do you build a sort of long-term sustainable revenue generating protocol? And really the core of that, I think, is to just move as fast as possible and produce as much innovation as possible. And I think Bancor's real sweet spot is continuing to develop the sort of core AMM privative. You know, I think this is something we really are just in the, even though we've been at this for, you know, 4+ years, we really are in the sort of early phases and the sort of first round of developing and evolving this protocol or this primitive until it really becomes the sort of core technology underlying the largest exchange, you know, venues in the world. You know, I'm thoroughly convinced that the NASDAQs or the New York Stock Exchanges of the world will have AMM, automated market makers, at their core. And, you know, so innovation is definitely progressing with the sort of core AMM model. You know, we created this in 2017. We saw it just massively explode to the point where it's pretty much a feature of every DeFi protocol, you know, and then in late last year, we feel like we really solved the two kind of core issues that were preventing a lot of liquidity from entering, you know, that being the sort of single-sided exposure and then also impermanent loss protection. And now we are super heads down and in a research phase that there is going to be a sort of major upcoming release. I can't say when, but I think that will once again sort of flip the AMM industry and the crypto exchange industry as a whole on its head. And while I don't think we can give the sort of specific features that will be a part of that, there are some sort of core pillars that are kind of driving development. I would say there's probably three ones that we've sort of addressed throughout this chat, but I can just sort of reiterate. I think the first is ensuring that there are as many assets as possible that are able to be whitelisted specifically on Bancor. So really lowering the barrier to whitelisting and making it, you know, easier and cheaper for token projects to bootstrap and incentivize liquidity on AMM. So that core pillar would probably be defined as, I guess, token onboarding. The next is really turning Bancor into sort of world-class trading venue, offering not only the best prices, but including, you know, charting and analytics and really novel tools for professional and retail traders. And that first effort was limit orders, but that's really just the beginning of turning Bancor.network into this venue where you not only swap and trade, but you also get sort of yield and you can borrow and this sort of new financial platform where you can do everything you might want to do in the DeFi ecosystem. And then I guess lastly is continuing to serve liquidity providers and users that hold assets in their wallet and want to get yield on them. We've seen a recent sort of shift in some of our competitors push way more towards the professional market maker, the same users that might use or market make on traditional exchanges, you know, on NASDAQ or New York Stock Exchange, or who might do, you know, traditional market making on an order book based exchange like Coinbase or Binance. And we are really pushing and continuing to sort of maintain a product that is accessible for passive liquidity providers, that doesn't require you constantly returning to your stake and monitoring changes in the AMM and in prices in order to update the pricing curve. We really think this adds sort of a lot of complexity and specialization into market making, such that, you know, this could become a world that is effectively like the world that we came from, traditional finance, in which it's dominated by the deepest pockets with the most specialized automated market making skills. And really, liquidity then sort of centralizes in the hands of the few, as opposed to having a market making solution that is automated and accessible to anyone who has idle assets. And that's not just the everyday individual Joe Schmo user. We do think our product is particularly well suited for them, but that's also all the liquidity in the world that is not, you know, an active trading firm. You think of a lot of hedge funds, a lot of, you know, funds and pensions in general that, you know, are long on assets, simply have them sitting in their wallets and want to put those to work and generate, you know, extremely high yield from market making and borrowing and lending activities. They don't want to, you know, be an active manager where they're constantly updating pricing curves and employ, you know, a whole team of algorithmic traders to do so. So it's really across the board that we see the opportunity for passive liquidity provision that AMMs effectively allowed for. We think that is going to very much continue on, and we're really looking forward to, you know, increasing the capital efficiency of these AMMs without sacrificing the usability by passive LPs. So those are these kind of three core tenants that are really driving development: the token onboarding, the designing this world-class trading venue, and finally the sort of financial access and control for passive LPs that want yield on their idle assets. And those are really going to be guiding this sort of major release that we can't talk about too much now, but we'll have, you know, a host of new kind of innovations in them and allow Bancor to do what it essentially did in its V2.1 release, which is to continue to capture more and more market share, both on the trading side amongst traders and also more of the liquidity side. You know, I think Bancor is really the fastest growing DeFi protocol in the beginning portion of the year. When you look at DEXs and when you look at trading volume, we were, I think, you know, a pretty small percentage of total DEX trading volume. And now we've seen that grow massively to the point where we're, you know, consistently in the sort of top three or top four by volume. And then in terms of revenue, even higher than that. In terms of actual protocol revenue that's being collected by token holders, I think, you know, it's really us and SushiSwap that are in the top two. There's DEXs like Uniswap and Balancer that actually the token holders don't really even collect any revenue whatsoever. It's all diverted towards LPs and the supply. So we're just continuing to innovate in order to continue, you know, capturing this this market share. And we have a couple of discoveries that we've really made just recently that we think are really going to launch Bancor into a pretty awesome position as we head into the second half of this year.
Or like some of the people in the crypto Twitter say, launch Bancor into the moon.
The goal.
But Nate, I couldn't have said it better myself. Thank you for both of you, Nate and Mark, for joining us today for Protocol Value. Loved everything that I heard so far from Bancor. Looking forward to new developments. Tell us where people can find Bancor. Where can people find you? The room is yours. Thank you for joining.
Yeah, sure. Our Telegram And Discord channels are quite active on Telegram. It's just t.me/Bancor. We have a channel just for protocol developments, specific liquidity provision strategies, and also for developers. We're also fairly active on Twitter at Bancor. I'm personally on Twitter at Nate Hinman, and it's the same Telegram handle. Feel free to directly message me anytime you want. And also, a really good way to keep track of Bancor developments is also in our governance channel. We're constantly having people contribute proposals and really signaling where the protocol is headed next. And that is gov.bancor.network, and also our blog at blog.bancor.network. And I'll let Mark shout out his Twitter handle and any other handles, because I don't know those offhand. Mark, go ahead.
So I'm pretty anti-anonymous. So if you just search my name, generally all of my social media profiles will come up. I use my name in Telegram, on Twitter, and on many of the cryptocurrency chat rooms and discourse pages with which I'm involved. But you can find my Twitter handle directly, which is at, I think, mbrichardson87. I hope that anyone who is interested will reach out if they want to chat. If you would need a more official way to get in touch with me, my email and Nate's email, by the way, is mark@bancor.network and nate@bancor.network. And so if you prefer that channel of communication, then by all means, we welcome it.
Awesome, guys. Thank you for joining for Protocol Value.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thanks a lot. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, everybody who joined us tonight for this amazing episode of Protocol Value. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to our podcast on your given choice of listening platform. And if you want to learn more about this episode and more about what we're doing here at Protocol Value, visit protocolvalue.com and you'll find a lot more detail, not only about this episode, but much, much more. But until then, we'll see you guys in the next one. Have a good day.